Hi, I'm John LeDrew, and since October 2016, I have interviewed over 30 people in over 60 hours of recorded interviews. I wanted to get to the core of what safety is and why it's important. This turned out to be quite an adventure. Welcome to the Agile Path. Three weeks ago, we started our journey with our first episode, In Search of Safety. Shortly after each episode is released, we'll bring together some contributors for a discussion inspired by the issues raised. This was originally streamed on the 5th of April and features Tim Ottinger, Joanna Rothman, Lisa Crispin, and Amitai Schleyer. First though, warning, spoilers ahead. If you haven't had a chance to listen to our first episode yet, you're going to want to go back and listen to that first. Don't worry, we'll be right here when you get back. We had a wide-ranging, fascinating discussion covering many areas on how to foster safety and things to notice in unsafe organisations. So, I hope you're ready. Let's dive right into the conversation. This is the Agile Path Retrospective. I'd be really interested to find out what were the things that most resonated with you, which were the kind of issues that you've seen in your own experiences working as coaches and working with organizations. So Amitai, do you want to kick off?
Gosh, first thing that jumps out at me is something I saw very recently, is that a team composition was changed, and not for the first time, without their involvement, without their being apprised of it. It was kind of sprung on them. It was sprung on their delivery lead. They had invested in a new teammate. The teammate had started to be productive for them. And that teammate had come in because a previous person had been removed from the team kind of abruptly. And so the safety there, they had a nice office. They had a nice place to work. Those of them that were not immediately removed from the team liked each other a lot and worked well together. But it seemed like there's this, and it wasn't just once, that's the trick. It seemed like there was this threat, is maybe not the word, but realistic probability that whoever is here today may not be here tomorrow. And you may not know why, and you may never learn why. And it could be you. And so that gave me a bad feeling.
All right. So what really stood out for me is the fact that we put so much effort on hiring for technical skills. And what really counts is our interpersonal skills. Because without interpersonal skills, we don't know how to create safety. And Arlo talked about the abusive manager. There were other things that people talked about, all of this really crazy stuff. Amitai's story just now of, you know, who knows when you're gone? Why would you be gone? Why would you be there? So we hire for technical skills, but we fire for interpersonal skills. And part of the problem is that managers don't get fired when they have horrible interpersonal skills. Mm-hmm. So they end up doing a lot more damage. I think one of the things I took out of this is I have to finish the book I'm working on now so I can write the Agile Manager Guidebook. And then it's not going to be called that. It's going to be called something else. And how do we help people understand that their interpersonal skills are possibly more important than their technical skills?
One of the things that struck me is how hard it is to define safety. How do we define if this is a safe environment? And a couple of people in the podcast made that point that it's, well, as humans, we can sense it, but it's hard to put your finger on exactly what it is. We agreed in our own team, in the smaller pods, we feel safe and comfortable to express an opinion that might be different or whatever. But we both agreed that we didn't feel that way on the larger team. The same people, but in a larger team. But we can't explain why that is. So it's hard to define.
Absolutely. I think that was my main motivation to start with this topic was the enigmatic nature of this thing. The weirdest question for me was the fact that it seemed that this was so important and critical, yet very few people could give me a definitive answer on what this thing was. It's almost like dark matter or something. It's there holding the universe together, but no one really knows what it is. So Tim?
Yes. So I kind of like how in the podcast, it came down to talking about workplace stress in particular. And I will agree that workplace stress is a result of unsafety. And I think that's important. The thing that I think is also interesting is in the story you told, there was such a lack of space for choices and thinking and agency. Mm-hmm. It was always reactive, always reactive. And I think that is a classical picture. You don't have safety when everything is either prohibited explicitly or required explicitly, and there's no room in between.
Somewhat inspired by my own work experiences, but pretty certain that many individuals have had similar experiences really to that. I think I was trying to create a composite somewhat of kind of crappy environments from around the world to the unfortunate main character who doesn't have the best experience in the story, unfortunately.
I hope that main character is doing better now.
I don't know. I've just written one additional story, which I won't give away, but it doesn't start well. But we'll see. Turns into a bit of a murder mystery in the next episode. Not quite murder, but you know. Okay, so I think there's some really interesting points. So I think the core of the episode was this idea of trying to work out what is safety? What does it really mean? And interestingly, Amitai, you actually said in your quote, you can almost sense it by its absence. Which again makes me think that dark matter is the whole thing that this safety is. And I think when it gets really bad, it's like a black hole. It sucks everything else into it, but you still can't see it itself necessarily. What would you say your own personal definitions for safety are? Somebody said, what is this thing? What would you personally describe?
I would tend to see safety as, so in inverse, it's unsafety is the need to censor your agency.
I guess the inverse of that is the freedom to not be censored or the freedom to be expressive without that censorship.
Yeah.
So if I could add something else there, because you know me, I can always talk. Tim's ideas are resonating with me. And I think that there's a bunch of stuff here about what Dan Pink talks about in Drive, autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Mm. That when you have a purpose, you feel safe to exercise your autonomy and mastery. Mm. And maybe you're not totally autonomous as a single human, but maybe the key is the team is autonomous to explore and to create an environment of mastery. And that allows the team to continue. So I think one of the saddest things for me in that episode was that this is one guy all by himself. And I have been that guy, right? So I was a girl, but I think it's really important to say, how do we create a safe environment for people to work together? Because I don't actually know of anything worth doing, and I'm not counting vacuuming or anything, that you can do by yourself. Everything in my world, you have to do with other people. So how can we create safety for a team?
In a way, it's possible to do lots of things on your own, but when it's creative, when it's inherently collaborative, especially problem solving, which is what most of us do day to day, at whatever level, whether you're a coach or a software developer or a manager, it's almost always collaborative and creative, and it's always problem solving. It's never effective when you're on your own. I'm never more effective when I'm on my own. I'm better when I'm able to bounce ideas off people and able to communicate with people.
Part of it for me is that each team member should be equally valued, and there shouldn't be assumptions that, well, that person's a tester, so she doesn't know anything about code, or that person's a developer, so they don't know anything about business analysis or design, whatever it is. And as a tester, I do run into that a lot. Because you're not equally valued, your contributions aren't equally valued. There's some kind of class system in place. So some people might feel safer than others.
So I've been talking a lot about safety in different places. And one of the points I make is everyone has to have accountability for fostering safety and noticing. So you've got to notice when someone else is actually feeling unsafe in your team and keep an eye out for those things. Phelan was talking about how people often see it as the facilitator. In some cases, that might be the scrum master or the team leader or someone with authority normally. They're responsible for creating safety. They're responsible for creating that bubble. But that causes that in itself is a real problem, because then everyone is delegating this responsibility for safety. You know, oh, someone said something that's making someone feel unsafe, and everyone just looks over at the manager. And actually, a truly safe environment is where everyone can stand up and kind of go, yeah, John, you're talking too much, you know, shut up and let someone else speak, you know, for example. And that's important to for creating a safe environment. So on that note, Amitai.
Yeah, John, you're speaking too much. I heard that's a good thing to say.
Thank you.
No, that was quite a good point. So one aspect of safety is a reliable internet connection, so you can stay in the conversation that you're in. We'll have to work on that. Yeah. What jumps out to me when I listened to the episode a couple times and tried to synthesize something new for myself is, so I had that idea about contingency, which is the opposite of safety. Mm. In other words, what could happen badly if I do this badly? In other words, what's the worst case outcome? If I screw this up, or if I do this in a way that somebody else doesn't like, what is at risk for me? Am I at risk of having this kind of decision taken away from me next time? Am I at risk of being removed from this team and put on a different project? Am I at risk of being out on my butt without a job? Am I at risk of like a terrible reputation that prevents me from getting another job? What's at risk? And then how well-founded is that? Would anybody else on the team agree that I should be worried about that when I make this decision? And if I have this concern, and it seems like it's a well-founded concern, and then I guess the just world hypothesis enters into it, does it seem right that if I make that mistake, I should be in that kind of trouble? And if all that coheres, then maybe that's safety. If anything is out of joint, then maybe I don't have safety.
That's interesting, because it leads a little bit into the just world idea. It is interesting because as I'm working on the next episode, which is all about blame, it's an interesting idea. Do we think that safety should be gone almost as a punishment for an individual that's not performing or not delivering? That's an interesting question. What do you guys think? Do you earn safety?
Well, there's a difference between safety and trust.
Yeah.
Right. So I can trust somebody or not trust them and still feel safe around them. So for me, safety and trust are a different thing.
Esther Derby said, we have a very strange idea about trust in the Western world, that we tend to see it as a point measurement, but it's not really. It's a spectrum of spectra, right? How much you trust me depends. You might trust me to watch your bag while you go to the restroom, but that doesn't mean you trust me to carry your checkbook around. Maybe you trust your spouse with the household finances, but not necessarily with your career direction, or vice versa. So there's things you trust and things you don't. So I think that you can't say trust without saying trust to do or to manage something. And I think it is very different from safety. I think that they do have intersections, right? But are you familiar with David Rock's scarf threats?
No.
So what seems to be suggested by the neuro leadership research that's been done, and this is functional MRI, so you can decide how much you want to trust it all and all that. But what seems to be suggested is that there are psychological threats that our bodies respond to as if they were physical threats. And they create the same kind of a stress situation, the hormones and the panic and the inability to think clearly, the inability to retrieve long-term memories. The SCARF is an acronym. It is, the first one is to status. So if we are in fear for our status, that debilitates us somewhat. The C is for certainty. People feel a threat when they don't know what might happen next. Such as an organization I know where people were fired by zip code. So it had nothing to do with your performance, right? So that's C. A is autonomy. An autonomy threat makes you feel like you're being controlled and you lose your agency. So SCAR is relatedness, which is your position within your in-group. Is this going to cost me my relationships? And then the last one, F, is fairness, which seems to be hardwired into people. So if we all do a bunch of work, and then at the end, I get given a large gift certificate and a vacation to Hawaii, and you don't, what's the first thought in your mind? That's not fair. That has to be corrected. So those are the five primary threats. And I think the presence of those threats is what destroys safety. And trust may be a different thing entirely.
I had a really interesting conversation with Woody Zuhl, and he questioned, he was like, well, do we really need trust? Is trust really important? Isn't it a bad thing that we create systems that depend on high levels of trust to work in the first place? I kind of went away thinking, of course, trust is important. This is nonsense. In my back of my mind, I just couldn't get it at all. And then the more I've cogitated upon it, I can see this point that trust becomes this weird thing that we trade between each other in teams that I don't think ever really help. You look at some of the work Amy Edmondson has been doing with team skeletons. Basically, she was looking at this area where teams, high-performing teams that need to work very effectively, like, for example, in a hospital emergency room. So you've got a team of people. Now, interestingly, those people are all on shift work. You may well turn up as the nurse on shift, and you could well not have ever worked with any of the other people on because they're all agency staff. But you still need to be able to collaborate very effectively and very quickly save the life of this person who's in recess in front of you. And obviously, these people haven't been chatting around the water cooler to build up interpersonal relationships and trust. That's not a possibility. The answers are that it's the first time they've ever worked in that hospital. But still, they have to. Trust is definitely separate from safety because those teams were safe. Those teams and hospitals are safe. But I wouldn't say there was trust in the same way that we might describe it there. There might be some other kind of trust.
Well, that's the same kind of trust that pilots in an airplane have. And that's because there's a handshake of acceptable behavior and acceptable wording for how to talk about regular stuff, emergency situations, anything like that. The Korean pilots, the culture of the people made more problems in the cockpit. And so they move from speaking in Asian language, I think it was Korean, I'm not altogether positive, to English, because the kind of hierarchical forms do not exist in English. So people started to talk to each other as colleagues and as equals, and that led to equality in the cockpit, which is why, with some very rare exceptions, airplane travel is very, very safe because the people in the cockpit understand how to talk to each other. And maybe that's the kind of safety we need in our teams. We don't, as Tim says, we don't necessarily need trust on all levels because trust is a spectrum. I like that you said a spectrum of spectra. Let's go meta here. And I like the idea that I don't have to extend personal trust if I have that notion of safety, that if we have the correct handshaking, whatever that handshaking is, then we can have a safe environment or a safe enough environment to do our work.
That reminds me talking to Mary Poppendick, and she spoke about high reliability organizations, which is what we were just both talking about indirectly, airlines, hospitals. Terrifyingly, I point out, hospitals aren't completely all on board with this yet. The airlines have been for a long time. But the interesting point there was that she didn't really like the word safety. What they call it there in high reliability organizations is an environment of mutual respect. That's the handshake. That's the secret handshake that they all know, that they know that it's okay for a nurse to say to a doctor or a surgeon, this isn't right. Let's, you know, that doesn't look right. You know, please operate on the guy's head. That's his big toe, you know, you might need to review the situation. I don't want to question your authority, but I'm pretty certain that's his big toe, you know, put the scalpel down. And that has to be okay, obviously, in those circumstances. That has to be a safe thing to do.
On the rare occasions that I've seen a high performing team, it seems like it's an unstable equilibrium every time, that if they're flying a plane, so to speak, there's a lot of drag and it doesn't take much to go over a threshold where there's more drag than lift. Most agile teams don't get as far as there'd be more lift than drag. And as soon as they do, then somebody has to run around making sure that stays true. And as soon as it stops being true, they fall right off. Maybe the hint that Woody was giving us with that question, certainly the way that it strikes me, is why does it have to be such an unstable equilibrium? Why does it have to be the case that to get to where we're high-performing in the first place, we need so much trust? Because it's very easy to lose some and then we're in trouble all of a sudden. And that's, you know, that's like a lack of meta safety. If we're safe now, we might be really close to being not safe soon. Absolutely. And I wonder if that's what his question was about.
That hasn't been my experience on a team that has really gelled and that people would call it a high performance team. I mean, not that we didn't have problems, but I don't think the level of trust or the feeling of safety, we could still have bad problems, but we were able to fix them or overcome them faster than a team that had just been thrown together or constantly moved around or something would be able to do.
I think there is a difference because when I think about my own experience, like the best team I ever worked on was one of the first jobs that I ever had. And we were a sysadmin team. We didn't really have a manager. We just worked and we really knew each other. You know, we'd worked together for quite a while. We knew each other really well. We knew what each of us should do. You know, if you know where you fit in, because the stuff is in the fan and flying all over the place, and you will need to know which bit you're going to be, I don't know, wiping, I guess, to continue that slightly disgusting analogy. And that was something that worked really well for us. And there was definitely interpersonal trust there. And that was beneficial to that relationship. But I think that there's a different challenge, perhaps, with teams that have other challenges for whatever reason. They're just general operational situations, like a team in a resus room in a hospital, and there's just shifts. So you don't necessarily know who's going to be there at any one moment, and you still have to collaborate. So maybe there's just a difference there. There's different kinds of teams and they face different challenges. If it's possible to build a high-performing, high-reliability team in a hospital or in an airline without that need for trust in the same way, without that kind of interpersonal relationship, does it need to be there or does it not be my thought?
I have a suggestion that maybe there's two things that kind of have to be brought into the conversation. One is with pilots and surgical teams. Their primary focus is on the work they're doing, not on the population of the room. I found this with pair programming. It's great when you're concentrating on the code. It's lousy when you're thinking about each other the whole time. And that seems to be a real key, is that it's about being focused on work. But the other piece is, I have found that excellence tends to grow in the shade of an umbrella. If you don't have somebody somewhere in an organization that carves out that space where you know that you are free from abuse and blame, which quite frankly, in many old organizations and old style organizations, abuse and blame, scapegoating, those were privileges of rank. The people above can always abuse the people below. The people in power, the people who have the technical knowledge, can always make fun of the noobs. And it's okay because they're the, you know, they're the chief. They're the ones in charge. And I think that there always has to be an umbrella somewhere that establishes the idea that we're not going to do that. That kind of silliness is not okay here. And within that umbrella, that we're not here to blame each other, to throw each other under the bus. We're not here to abuse each other. That's totally not cool. We're here to lift each, to concentrate on the work and get it done excellently. I think that makes a big difference. Those two things, I've just never seen it work without the two of them.
As a person who's been that umbrella, and that's what I had in mind, exactly this idea. Which may be why Lisa's experience is different from mine. I've been in organizations that mostly were not hotbeds of agility. And I've been on teams that anarchically decided that we needed to be to get the results we were after. And so I've been that umbrella. And I think an aspect of safety for me would have been knowing that when my umbrella starts to give out, someone else has one handy. And I never had that feeling. And I wonder how that affected the team that I was the umbrella for, knowing that it was me or bust, because I busted.
one of the things that that Mary was saying was obviously that the critical part of this creating an environment of mutual respect was policy to some degree. There needs to be a well-defined policy for how people interact and how people show respect for one another. And I think that there's a certain amount of things. I don't really think you can define strict rules and regulations for how everybody communicates. From my perspective, I don't know whether that helps, really. I certainly haven't had any experience defining policies like that in a...
Well, I have.
Oh, there we go.
I was the subject of one of those policies. Okay. And then when I became a manager, I abolished all of those policies. So I think it's a really interesting problem. So if you look at what Ed Schein says is culture, it's what people can discuss, how they treat each other, and what the organization rewards. And if you think about all three of those, yeah, you might need some policies about rewarding. You might need some policies about what you can discuss and cannot discuss in terms of especially safety, but how people treat each other, I really worry about that. So, okay, there's the discrimination and harassment part. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that. But I'm talking about, do I have to say, are you available to meet now so we can review our stuff or pair now? And aside from having the human connection to say, what time is good for you? Do I really need to phrase it in a way that is totally acceptable to everybody? I have been in those situations where I was supposed to phrase things in a particular way. And oh boy, that was a real pain in the tush. I think maybe policy is a key word for me that says, don't do that. And I'm not totally anarchical, but I really like very few policies, and mostly the policies that say we will treat each other as humans. Maybe not the way I want to be treated, but I should treat you the way you want to be treated. So policy seems to be a hot word for me.
Yeah, I think policies make a lot of sense when the cost of the thing we wish didn't happen is not necessarily unrecoverable, but too high. We don't want to have to pay whatever the cost is to recover from that. It could be that it's not a financial cost at all. It could be one of those sort of anti-privileges of rank, like somebody's going to come down on me if this mistake is made, so I can't afford for this mistake to be made, even though otherwise we could totally afford for that mistake to be made. And so policies usually come in. For me, they are generally coherent with a power structure. They reflect where the power structure is sagging.
Do you remember the Etsy story? At Etsy, an intern, I think, had made a simple change to some CSS. And it just so happened, cascading unintentional events, that it made it so that the login screen couldn't display and be operated. So nobody could get in for quite a period of time until they figured out what was wrong and fixed it. Of course, this intern now is terrified because here it is, you know, early in the job and a monumental screw up, right? Instead, it turns out that Etsy gives this award. It's a three-arm sweater they gave, thanking this intern for finding the hole in their delivery system that allowed these kinds of errors to slip through. Their focus was on the work. There was no official policy of scapegoating. It wasn't like, oh, this bug is there because some programmer put it in. No names mentioned. It is a different policy entirely, right? So maybe it's not the feeling that I'm always comfortable or we'll never make mistakes or we'll never have conflict. Maybe it's the feeling that those things aren't going to kill me.
I guess, though, in a way, you want to have a certain amount of discouragement for making mistakes. We don't want to encourage people to take sites down. We don't want people to be reckless, do we? How do you stop that? How do you create an environment where, I guess, recklessness isn't encouraged? We don't want junior developers just taking the website down because, hey, it's okay to push stuff live. Let's go for it. You know, maybe we don't want that, but I don't know. How do we make it okay to make mistakes, but not okay to be reckless?
I'm waiting for a race to the Deming quote.
Go ahead.
So this is probably not a real problem. Deming said that about 4% of errors are attributable to individuals. 96% of it belongs to the system, which, by the way, is the focus of management responsibility, I think he said. So I suspect that you don't really have people who are coming into the business to become programmers whose goal and desire and intent is to go create problems and break things and tear stuff down. I don't think recklessness is a personality defect. I think that for the most part, that's not true, maybe 4% of the time. There's something called the fundamental attribution error. It goes like this. If you trip over a rock, it's because you're a clumsy person. But if I trip over a rock, it's because that rock shouldn't have been in the middle of the sidewalk. Your faults are personality, minor circumstance.
And let me take another step off of that. So Tim just told the Etsy story about the three-arm sweater, right? So that they created a system where if people wanted to do something good, but how could this problem get through? It's a system problem. This is not a person problem. And every time you have a system problem, you could try and create more policies. Oh, the policies will increase. And then that does not help anything. Lisa and I happened to have a conversation earlier, and I should probably stop talking so Lisa can have this conversation with all of us. But it's about how testing can support the work of everybody. Lisa, take it away.
Where you're going with that?
Oh, because remember how you and I were talking about if people would do BDD or TDD or ATD,
oh, right. Yeah.
They would have the support to make mistakes. They would be exactly. able to do small, safe to fail experiments.
Right. Yeah. Rather than just leap in and okay, well, you did it wrong and we don't want to blame you for that, but we could have avoided it too pretty easily if we had thought about what tests we were going to do first. So yeah, you can put a bit of structure, I guess, or a bit of thought and conversation and capture examples and go from there rather than just diving in. So that's for sure.
And what that does is it brings consequences forward. And I think even in the rare cases where someone is genuinely being reckless and doesn't care whether they screw it up, 96% of the time, as it happens, I'm making that number up, but it sounds right. the what looks like recklessness from somebody who's suffering from the result is a lack of coherence between an action and a consequence. We didn't see that it was going to have that effect. We didn't know how to find out in some other way that it was going to have that effect. It does have that effect. And why did we think that one person was supposed to know that? Why did we think that all of us were supposed to know that? Why does that need to be known if we're going to go back to a Woody's Eel question? Why does it have to be the case that we know everything in order to take a safe step forward? What if we didn't have to know everything to take a safe step forward? Mm. And so I think, Lisa, what you're suggesting is that with BDD and with testing as sort of first class ideas that are brought forward, then we can all be thinking about those consequences from the beginning so that if something goes wrong, it's pretty clear that nobody was reckless. It's just that all of us didn't.
Right. And we know sooner rather than later, which is good. So, I mean, I know there's not a simple answer, but how do we build a sense of safety? Like I say, when my teammate and I were talking this morning, it's like, what will we do to make ourselves feel a better sense of safety across the larger team? And would you do team building? Like, what would you do? It all sounds kind of silly. I think with small teams, it's easier because we can have really productive retrospectives and really make changes on a daily and weekly basis and really get that feedback. But when you work with a large group of people, it's harder to do that. I'm not sure. I work on great teams that were allowed to self-organize and given the time and support to learn how to do that and to become a self-organizing, high-performing team, whatever you want to call it. But how do you do that with larger organizations?
So I, of course, have a supposition, because I always have a supposition, and that's that to take Tim's idea, you concentrate on the work. Does everyone need to be involved in all of this work? Often, I see large teams, right? There's program teams and all these other people where you really need a core group of people to do something. And then all the other people are ancillary for that. And so why have everyone involved? Instead, why not have people who focus on this work focus on it? Mm-hmm. And then the other people can go off and do their work. So I think it's an issue of how do we help people do the work that they want to do or they need to do, and then let all the other stuff go.
So it's unrealistic to even expect a larger organization to be able to have those relationships. They're better off staying in smaller groups so that they can have the relationships they need to do their work.
Well, I think you can have communities of practice, and that allows people to build relationships across the organization. But I'm not so sure it's really worth it trying to get 40 people or 50 or 60 people together and say, oh, you're a big team. Let's all do kumbaya.
There is.
It is required, though. There's no way to get the work done without that.
No.
It's all kumbaya all the way down. Yeah.
So squatting somewhere firmly in the middle of our room is the Dunbar number. We may be up against biology here. Mm-hmm. There are only so many active, healthy, strong, powerful relationships you can have at one time. Your brain apparently is only built for so much community. And certainly a large organization, at some point, you have to abstract. What if instead of managing 50 individuals, you managed 5 teams and you treated each team as a person? And you didn't try to go beyond that barrier. It was an atomic level. Here's what we assigned to the team. Here's what the team did. Now I can multiply that a bit, but I'm still stuck with Dunbar. I just can't manage more than 200 relationships outside of my own head. It's beyond me. It's biologically impossible, probably.
But then are we really talking about teams of, what was I watching recently? I think it was the Lean Mindset talk at Agile India recorded Mary Poppendick again. And she was talking about what she considers to be kind of an ideal team size. And for her, that kind of 30 person team was sort of like what she thought was like a really ideal size. Now that isn't a, that's not a scrum team. We're not talking about the Amazon pizza size teams there, but if you want a group of people that are going to self-organize around the work, and that does not mean that they all need to get into one big 30 person stand-up, which no one would want to be in. It's about me picking up a card and going, all right, this card, what is this? I don't know. I need to log in. All right. Who wants to build the login with me? Okay. I need a tester. I need a designer, or maybe even this card is even better than that. Maybe it's describing a business level need, like, hey, we need to increase sales on, you know, on the toothpaste product that we sell by 10% this quarter. Let's get everyone together. I need some salespeople in here. I need this. I need a proper cross-functional team. I need some business people.
No. I'm sorry. That's a program. And maybe it's a 30-person small program, but it's not one team.
Okay.
So let's talk about the difference. And I only have a few minutes. Let's talk about the difference between one team that can get a set of features through it, and then the general overall teaminess of the organization to get a product out the door. So those two things are very, very different, right? Mm. So it just makes me infuriated, as you can tell, when the lean people start to talk about 30-person teams and 50-person teams. They're not freaking teams. they're designed to get products out the door. So let's separate the product at the door from the flow of features. And almost, there are very few software teams that can get the product at the door by themselves. Yes, you need a program, or at least to involve other people. Absolutely. But those are people, those software teams can only get the flow of features through the team. They need other people. And if you have 30 people, you have a small program. So manage it like that. Don't say, well, we're all one big team and we'll all have ice cream together. I just know it. Makes me nuts, as you can tell.
I just have one question.
It's not unrelated to the problem we have with the word agile. Like, it's just a nice umbrella. Everybody wants to be in under it. Team sounds great. This group of people is a team. Whether or not they're a team, they're a team. It's a nice.
I just have one question. Yeah, and that's it. Joanna, what do you have against ice cream?
I love it. That's right. Part of the problem.
The end of the podcast, which was some of the relationships between workplace stress and safety and other things. I had no idea how big a problem workplace stress really was. I mean, obviously, we all know that stress is there and it's a problem, but when you actually look at it being 2/3 of the workforce, and that's roughly the same, if a bit higher, when you look at the stats internationally, that's kind of shocking, really. I posited that when I'm engaged at work, that increases my resilience to stress. So I could be working as a nurse in a hospice, for example. Now, the emotional stress that I receive is going to be pretty much the same. It's going to be pretty intense. It's going to be stressful day in, day out, regardless of any other input or anything else. There's going to be high levels of emotional stress there. But if I'm really engaged and connected with that work, I probably will feel it less than maybe another person might do as a result of the engagement that I feel, or the passion I feel for the work, perhaps is another word that could be used. And I was wondering whether or not that scene rang true for people's experiences.
Did you, in the course of that, learn about the Yerkes-Dodson effect? It is a stress performance curve. It's very interesting. Basically, it shows that for very simple tasks, as the arousal increases, and arousal is just any kind of positive stress or negative, so motivation, we'll call it that. As that rises, on simple tasks, you'll reach a maximum and you'll pretty much hang out there. So if you're doing simple work, a little more stress probably won't hurt that much.
Yeah.
On the other hand, when you're doing intellectual labor, that thing collapses like a son of a gun.
Yeah.
You reach a point where there's enough stress that you can no longer do the work. I think that when you're engaged, you're on the healthy side of that stress curve. you're at a point maybe beyond comfort, but where you're getting some peak performance and you're really focused and it's a good thing and you can get work done. But you can certainly get over that hump and collapse. And a sense of threat is different from an urgency. And you'll find that people who are under a sense of threat will collapse much more quickly than people who are just dealing with a lot of work.
Yeah, which takes us back to the SCARF model that you were talking about earlier, actually, as well. Yeah, that's really interesting. So that, just out of interest, has anyone else had that experience? I think in the podcast, I gave two examples of working through the night because your boss says you need to get this damn thing finished or you're fired, versus working through the night because you're engaged in what you do, you just get lost in what you're doing. There's obviously a difference between those two things.
I can give you a quick example. I have never really dealt well with all-nighters. That's just not part of my personality or capability. And I was a software developer for a company that had created its own problems just in time for the user group meeting. So the stuff that worked 3 weeks ago no longer worked. The meeting was in 2 days. And of course, we had no version control. Let's not even go there. So, so they said, Johanna, we really need you to do this. And I said, you know, I'm not the right person. I didn't write the code. I might be able to find it, but I'm not sure I can do this in 2 days and you really need it. And they said, oh no, you are the right person and we need it in 2 days. So I was told I was going to do this. I was given a deadline and I said, and oh, by the way, I don't pull all-nighters. And they said, why not? So it was one of those things where I said, I will do my best, but do not expect an answer for this. And I did not succeed. I did not know enough, and they didn't give me anybody else to talk with. Right? If I had been able to have a conversation, if I had paired with somebody, I might have been able to do it. But alone, with a deadline, not even a chance.
Makes you wonder if they wanted success as an outcome.
Makes you wonder.
I think you could say that very thing about 9 out of 10 teams that I've worked with sometimes. You do sometimes look at it and you think, the amount of times you are tripping up over your own feet, I swear you are putting those feet that way deliberately. So this can't be accidental anymore. So we're coming up to the last minute. By my clock, we have about 30 seconds left. Does anyone want to say anything before we finish? And otherwise, thank you very much, everyone, for your time today.
Thank you. And I have a page of notes.
Me too. I know. I've got so many things to go learn about.
Yeah.
I just learned a curve that describes a thing that happened to me.
Right. Excellent. Well,
everyone needs a curve to describe the thing that happened to you.
I wish everybody could love each other the way this group of people do. There's a lot of common affection and respect here. And if they can't, then I wish everybody could learn to respect each other the way this group is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks very much, everyone. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you and see you again soon. Thanks very much.
You have been listening to The Agile Path. Many thanks to this episode's interviewees, Tim Ottinger, Joanna Rothman, Lisa Crispin, and Amitai Schleyer. You can visit agilepath.fm for more information about all the interviewees in this and other episodes in this season, as well as additional supplementary material accompanying each episode. We love to hear your feedback and suggestions. Continue the conversation with us at AgilePathFM on Twitter and Facebook, or you can email us on hello@agilepath.fm. If you see value in what we're doing, then please leave us a review in iTunes or Stitcher. It only takes a moment and helps more people find us. The music from this season was performed and composed by Austin Wintory from his album, Monaco, What's Yours is Mine. And the theme music was composed by Austin Wintory and arranged and performed by Laura Intravia, from the album Monaco Gentleman's Private Collection. See agilepath.fm/safety/music for more information about the music from this season, including links to purchase the albums. Next up, we'll dive into the murky depths of shame, blame, fear, and punishment. See you next time, and may you stay on your agile path.